you to make your way there at this time. It can be hard to take the long view of things, can't it? I remember when I was in high school, I went through numerous different phases like any normal high schooler would. And some of you sitting here today have the distinct displeasure of having seen me grow up throughout my high school years. I went through what was, I don't even know what you'd call it anymore, sort of a goth emo phase. I was in a hardcore metal band, and I wore only black, and I had black hair, and it was styled in what at the time was called the reverse mullet, which means that it was long in front and short in back, and sort of swooshed across one side of your face real cool-like, right? And I had black fingernail polish, and I was in this hardcore metal band, and it just was, it was the greatest thing you'd ever see. And honestly, let me just come clean with you. I spent more time than I should have this week looking on Facebook trying to find pictures of this because I wanted you to enjoy it as much as those of you who actually had seen me, but I couldn't find pictures of it. I mean, this is before the time when I got my first Nokia brick phone. So there wasn't any cell phones with cameras or, you know, so you couldn't Snapchat this stuff or Instagram it. So thankfully, I guess, for me, and thankfully for you, you don't have to see pictures of me in this phase. Yeah, it's like it never happened at all. I could pretend that. But I remember my dad in particular talking after the fact. He didn't say this to me in the moment, thankfully, but after the fact, him talking about his interactions with other parents who were dealing with difficult parenting situations. And of course, at the time, I didn't think that I was the difficult parenting situation. No kid does. But I remember him saying that his counsel to parents in situations that were difficult was, you just have to take the long view of things. Because if you don't, you're just going to get really discouraged, right? When you see the way that your kid is acting or the way that your kid is dressing, you're just going to kind of freak out. You got to just realize that this is a phase. You just got to look at the whole big picture. But in the moment, that's difficult, isn't it? When you're in the midst of some sort of season in your vocation where you are not in a job that you enjoy or don't know if your career is actually going anywhere. When you're in a difficult parenting situation where your children are just in the midst of a difficult season of life and parenting them, or maybe your children are older and making choices that you wish they weren't making. It's hard to take the long view when you think about singleness. If you're in a season or a vocation of singleness, it's difficult to take the long view when you have friends who don't know Jesus, who you've been praying for years, and they don't seem to show any interest in spiritual things. It's difficult to take the long view when you're in circumstances that just leave you without any ability to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And as we make our way throughout the storyline of the Bible, we're faced with the difficulty of taking the long view. What we're told in the Bible is that God is a promise-making and promise-keeping God. But if we're honest, don't his actions in the world seem tediously slow to us? Throughout the Bible, we're told that God is, we see this unfolding story of God's plans being made known to us. But his plans are not made known to us over the course of hours or months or even years, but over the course of generations. And it's difficult because it forces us to take a long view of things. And sometimes we find ourselves asking the question, God, can't you just get on with it? I'd like for us to leave here today having looked at 2 Samuel chapter 5, being encouraged that the slowness of God is for our good. So let's look at the text. Scene 1, God's people come under the rule of God's king. In the book of 1 Samuel, we see the Israelite people constantly in conflict with a group of people called the Philistines. All throughout the book, they're constantly in war and in conflict. We get to 2 Samuel, and it's like the camera angle pans this direction, and the Philistines aren't really even mentioned in the first 5 or so chapters. And it's almost like there's this external threat that has been talked about in 1 Samuel, and the camera shifts to an internal threat that we see that is the conflict between the house of David and the house of Saul. So there's conflict and war and turmoil within God's people. And we pick up the story in chapter 5, verse 1. All of the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" So at this point, half of the nation of Israel has already pledged their allegiance to David, but there's this other half that had been loyal to the house of Saul. And at this point in the story, those who are loyal to the house of Saul send representatives to come to David and pledge their allegiance to him. And they say, "We are your flesh and blood." They say, "You've already been leading us." Notice what they say. "In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns." So David is not some unknown, mysterious person. He's someone who is well known to these people. And in fact, we see in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 5, whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. And in fact, David's military success is what caused Saul to hate him so much, because he was afraid of him. He felt threatened by him. So they say, "We're your flesh and blood. You have already been leading us, and God has established you as our king and our shepherd. The Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" So the people affirm David as their king, and notice that along with their affirmation of David as king is sort of this, it's sort of a side way of acknowledging that they have rebelled against God and his king. Don't you hear that? They're saying, "You've been leading us. God has established you. We know this." So there's sort of an admission of, we have been rebelling against God, and we've been rebelling against God's king by being loyal to Saul instead of to you. Now, we've got to try as hard as we can to hear this from the perspective of an Israelite person at this time. God had made a promise to a man named Abraham that he would give him an offspring, he would give him a large family, and that through his family, all the nations of the world would be blessed, and that God would give him an inheritance or a land. So God's people had been anticipating and waiting for that time to come. As Abraham's family grew, they found themselves slaves in Egypt. Under Moses, God led his people out of Egypt into the wilderness. Under Joshua, God led his people into the promised land, and they began to drive back the enemies that they faced there. After Joshua died, though, things sort of took a downward turn, and there was the period of the judges. There was no king over Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, is what the book of Judges tells us. So this period of judges where God, in his mercy, raised up leaders who are not even necessarily good leaders or godly people or just people, but God in his mercy had spared the Israelite people through these judges, and it's out of the context and the messiness of all these judges that God's people demand that God give them a king. So God gives them a king, and who do they get? They get Saul, who, by every outward appearance, would make a great king. He's a successful military leader. He's tall, he's handsome. But we know that as the story unfolds, his kingship was not everything that the Israelite people had hoped it would be. So Saul was a failure of a king, and God's people are anticipating and expecting the time when a new, better king is going to come. And so David comes on the scene, and the people of Israel realize, you are the king that we've been waiting for. God's people finally have God's king. And so the question is, what's going to happen next? Scene two, God's people receive their inheritance. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 5, starting in verse 6. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. The Jebusites said to David, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and lame can ward you off." They thought, "David cannot get in here." Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David. On that day, David had said, "Anyone who conquers the Jebusites will have to use the water shaft to reach those lame and blind who are David's enemies." That is why they said, "The blind and lame will not enter the place." So Jerusalem at this point was not a well-known or important city as far as the Israelite people were concerned. Really, the only mention of Jerusalem to this point in the Bible is when Abraham encounters a priest named Melchizedek, who's from the city of Salem, which is Jerusalem. But up until this point, that's really the only mention of Jerusalem that we see in the Bible. God's people were commanded under Joshua to go into the land and to take possession of it, and to a degree they did, but they failed to drive out the people in the way that they were supposed to. We read in Exodus 3, verse 17. God says, "And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey." And this Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, this is a list of nations that is repeated multiple times leading up to and even after this passage here. So the Jebusites were one of the groups that God's people were supposed to have driven out of the land, but it's clear that they had not driven them out. And so David here has to go up in conquest of the city of Jerusalem. And if you notice, as I was reading the text, they're sort of in this insult match. David says to them, "Anyone who conquers the Jebusites is going to have to use the water shaft to reach those lame and blind." So he's insulting the Jebusites, saying, "Okay, fighting against you guys is as easy as fighting against a bunch of crippled blind people." And then, of course, he says back, "Even the lame and blind can ward you off, David." So they're insulting each other back and forth, and in an honor and shame culture, these insults may have carried a little bit more weight than they carry with us today. But nonetheless, they're insulting each other, and both of these guys are very confident. Do you sense that? David's confident, but the Jebusites are confident too, and they've actually got a good reason to be, because in Joshua 15:63, we read that Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living in the city of Jerusalem. They tried to kick them out, and they had a short-term success, but in the long run, they were not able to drive out the Jebusite people, and so they're like, "Okay, you've tried this once before and failed. Why would I think that you're going to be able to do it this time?" So they're very confident. But in the end, we're told in verse 7, "Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David." And we're told that it was because the Lord God Almighty was with him. So we read in verse 9, "David then took up residence in the fortress and called it the City of David. He built up the area around it from the terraces inward, and he became more and more powerful because the Lord God Almighty was with him." In fact, he became so powerful and so well known in the area that there were envoys from surrounding peoples who came to give offerings to David. You see in verse 11 that Hiram, king of Tyre, sent envoys along with cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. So these guys see how powerful militarily David is, and they say, "Okay, we're not gonna mess with this guy. So we're gonna send him a bunch of gifts. We're gonna build him a palace, and we're gonna take our resources and do something to make him happy so that he doesn't turn his sights against us." The point here is that David is doing what Israel failed to do. Israel was supposed to drive out the people from the land, they didn't do it. And under David, this is coming to fulfillment. Scene three, God's people experience victory over their enemies. In verse 17, when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him, but David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hands?" The Lord answered him, "Go, for I will surely deliver the Philistines into your hand." So as David becomes more and more powerful and more successful, the opposition of the Philistines is rekindled. So notice the contrast between the king of Tyre sends gifts to David, and the Philistines, their opposition is kindled and they come against him in war. They came against him in full force, and we're told two times that David inquired of the Lord. And I want to just draw your attention to verse 21. David defeated the Philistines, and the Philistines abandoned their idols there, and David and his men carried them off. One of those details that might slip by us, but if we're familiar with the story of 1 Samuel as well as 2 Samuel, we'll remember that there was a different time when Israel came against the Philistines, but in the first time they encountered, the Philistines defeated the Israelites and carried off the Ark of the Covenant. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, so the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So the Ark is carried off. But what's really interesting is what happens after this. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So I thought, we don't know how, but the thing fell over. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. So the people start to get a little bit afraid at this point. So they move the ark around. They send it from one city to the next city. And we're told that the Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. So the ark of the Lord is carried off from this battle, and the gods in their temple are falling over and breaking to pieces, and the people are afflicted with tumors. Notice what happens here in 2 Samuel. The Philistines are defeated in battle now. They leave their idols, which were clearly no help to them in battle. And what happens? Absolutely nothing. Do you see the contrast that's being made? They carried away the idols of the Philistines and nothing happened. So in other words, the Israelite people are experiencing victory over their enemies and the idols of the Philistines are proven to be false gods. So at this point in the story, it seems like everything is turning around for the Israelite people. They've rebelled against God and his king, but now they have returned and they are loyal to David. They've failed to take possession of the land, but under David, they are now conquering the people that they were supposed to have driven out the first time. They've been constantly under threat by the Philistines, and now they're pushing them back and proving their idols to be false gods. Everything seems to be going well for God's people, But there's hints in the story that things are not going to continue on the path that they seem to be on right now. The first hint is in chapter 5, verses 4 and 5. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. So this is the first hint. The kingship, the reign of David, had a beginning and an end. And even if King David was the best king that has ever lived in the history of the world, his kingdom is going to last only as long as he does. So his kingdom, in essence, is temporary. David was only a human. But here's a second hint. After he left Hebron, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. We're 5 chapters into 2 Samuel, and this is the third time that the narrator says that David took more wives and had children born to him by them. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17, God is giving instructions for the king, the ruler of Israel. The king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver or gold. So God tells his people that the king is not to acquire many wives or concubines. And what we see here is that after he left Hebron, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem. Notice the names of these children. Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon. This is a foreshadowing of chapter 11. Do you remember who is the mother of Solomon? Bathsheba. So this is a foreshadowing of King David committing adultery, having this woman's husband murdered to cover it up. And it's at this point in the life of David, after Bathsheba, that his reign begins to slowly unravel and spiral downwards. So on the one hand, you have this wonderful picture of God's people are under God's king. God's people are driving back their enemies. God's people are receiving their inheritance. And yet at the same time, you have these foreshadowings of this is not going to stay like this forever. In the end, David could not be the king that God's people needed them to be. David could not be the king that God's people needed, which leaves us anticipating a better king. And it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later that King Jesus comes on the scene. And he's the king that David has left us longing for. This is made so clear in the New Testament. The very first sermon that was given, the first sermon on Pentecost. I'd invite you, just as an exercise, go through the book of Acts and read whenever there's a sermon, how often the kingship of Jesus is traced back to the person of David. In almost every single sermon, Jesus is linked to David. And here's what Peter says on that first Pentecost, therefore, let all Israel be assured of this, God has made this Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Messiah. Messiah is a Hebrew word which means anointed one or king. God has made Jesus king. You hear the same kind of language in Philippians chapter 2. Therefore, God has exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Jesus is the king that David leaves us anticipating and longing for. But he's not the kind of king that anyone expected. Immediately before his death, Jesus gets down on his hands and knees and he washes his disciples' feet. The most menial and degrading job that there was, the work of a slave. But this is the kind of king Jesus is. He's a servant king. In John's gospel, he makes it very clear that Jesus will be lifted up. Jesus will be exalted. And the exaltation that he's referring to is he's exalted, he's hung on a cross. His exaltation comes through being lifted up and crucified on a Roman cross, killed as a criminal. The inhabitants of Jesus' kingdom are not wealthy or beautiful or powerful or influential, although they can be. That's not what characterizes them. His kingdom is full of the poor and the marginalized and the disadvantaged, and not those people whose lives are all put together, but those people who realize that their lives are not all put together. Jesus is a completely different kind of king with a completely different kind of kingdom. It can be hard for us to take the long view of things, especially as we, as followers of Jesus, await the return of Jesus. We await his second coming to restore and to renew this world to be what it was designed to be and to restore us to who we were designed to be. It can be hard to take the long view when God seems to be so slow in his actions. But friends, can I just encourage you this morning? It's hard to take the long view, but here's what we know. The slowness of God is for our good. And we know this because of the cross. Each week we celebrate the cross by coming to the table. And so we do that once again this morning. And as we come to the table, I'd like to ask you to bow with me for a moment of confession.